to Flourishing Fully podcast. I'm really honored to have this year's Orthomolecular Hall of Famer recipient, Dr. Thomas Levy, with us today. He's an esteemed board-certified cardiologist. He's a world authority on vitamin C and author of several books, including Curing the Uncurable, Death by Calcium, Stop America's Number One Killer. They are must-read books. I encourage you all to get them on Amazon as quickly as you can. He lectures to professional groups internationally, and today he's going to give us some important information and concepts about vitamin C and its use in Lyme. Welcome, Dr. Levy.
Hello, Sally. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I have to tell the audience, as well as you, that you personally have impacted my life and my recommendations, and I want to share that information with our listeners. So let's begin. How did you get interested in vitamin C?
Well, that really began a little over 20 years ago when I met Dr. Hal Huggins, the maverick dentist in Colorado Springs, and I had the opportunity to visit his clinic, his dental clinic, but which he did a lot of nutritional and other work with his patients that came from around the world. And I saw some incredibly sick patients, patients that my internal medicine training told me you couldn't really make them better. Maybe you could give them a little symptomatic relief, and that was about it. Anyway, to make a long story short, there I had the opportunity to see some neurologic patients in wheelchairs go into the dental operatory and get a ton of dental work done, extractions, crowns, the type of thing that, like with a extracted wisdom tooth, might put a college kid on his back for a week. And these patients would come out of this more energetic than they went in, and wanting to go out to dinner and chew a steak on the side of their mouth that still had teeth. And I was flabbergasted, and I said, Hal, what's going on here? And Hal was a very sardonic, sarcastic type of person, and he just pointed at the IV bag. And I said, okay, thanks a lot. Yeah, IV, that helps a lot. He said, no, it's what's in it. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, there's 50 grams of vitamin C in there. And this was an infusion that was given before, during, and after the dental treatment. Well, I'm not one to deny what I see and experience for myself. And when I saw that scenario repeated on several occasions, I said, okay, I think it's about time you actually do a little research on vitamin C and try to figure out what's going on there. And that's sort of what began the voyage, if you will.
Yes, and so that led you to the work of Dr. Frederick Klenner, is that correct?
Well, Dr. Klenner was in the 1930s and 40s, and I think he died in the 60s. He was the one who, quite brilliantly, I mean, I still am flabbergasted over this, shortly after vitamin C was discovered by Dr. Albert St. George, and Dr. St. George received the Nobel Prize, Dr. Klenner, by some inspiration, again, I don't know how, by some inspiration, decided that vitamin C was going to be good for a lot of different things. And he managed to find a pharmaceutical company that could get him multi-gram doses of the vitamin C. And he started giving intravenous and intramuscular vitamin C to a wide variety of infectious diseases and just started curing them, period. He has one report in the literature where during the middle of a polio epidemic in North Carolina, in the late 1930s, I believe, 1939, he was able to treat 60 separate babies, infants, and young children who had polio, and he treated them all with injectable vitamin C, and he cured all of them in 5 days. 57 of them he cured in 3 days, and in three of them, he needed two more days to get the resolution. So that began an odyssey for Dr. Klenner, and he just wrote a lot. He wrote 20 different papers about vitamin C, and that was the initial literature that I was exposed to that told me, hey, something's going on here, and we need to take the work of Dr. Klenner and bring it into the 20th century if we can, and update it and upgrade it and make it as pertinent as possible for patients today.
So it's an essential vitamin because we don't make it, is that correct?
Yes, that's an interesting point, though, Sally, is that for whatever reason, I mean, you choose your explanation. I don't think there is a clear reason why, but as a species, the human being lost the enzyme in the liver to convert glucose into vitamin C. Most animals in the animal kingdom make their own vitamin C, and they generally live normal health spans without disease until they reach the end of their health span, and then they die. In the case of humans, as I'm sure you know, probably 50, 60, 70% of us after the age of 50 were on one or more prescription medications and were really chronically ill until we die. And that, I would submit to you, is the fact that we lost the gene to make our own vitamin C. There are some animals like the goat, which makes a lot of vitamin C, and a 150-pound goat the size of a regular human being will generally make 10, 11, 12 grams of vitamin C from the liver injected directly into the blood around the clock. And when you subject that goat to a life-threatening illness, he might make up to 100 grams. So it's very clear that nature has its own way of dealing with infections and diseases of chronic oxidative stress. And unfortunately, as a species, we lost that. And so we're all collectively sick together because of it.
Right. I think the audience is going to be really surprised. Could you comment and list the conditions that vitamin C ameliorates, reverses, and we're not actually allowed to say cure, are we? That people would be surprised to hear?
Really, all of the viruses caught at the acute stage, vitamin C will cure, at least in terms of what vitamin C has been tested against in human beings, in animals, and in the test tube. There's not a single virus against which vitamin C has not been able to directly neutralize, kill, and activate, whatever you want to call it. The only viruses that vitamin C is not immediately effective against are those that are what I call hidden viruses, HIV, chronic hepatitis. These viruses get deep into the cells, sometimes get incorporated in the DNA. They're not circulating in the bloodstream. And although vitamin C has had a lot of success against those infections as well, it's not as immediately successful as it would be if most of the virus load were circulating in the blood. With regard to bacteria, there's very few bacterial infections that vitamin C won't cure. It won't immediately make lists symptomatic as long as the infection is in an accessible tissue where you can get high enough concentrations of vitamin C in there. I might also add that in addition to having a direct antiviral and antibacterial effect by something called the Fenton reaction inside the cells because they all accumulate iron, vitamin C nonspecifically stimulates and supports the immune system by 20 different mechanisms at a minimum. And those are itemized in my book with the supporting research. And so even when vitamin C doesn't have the capacity, say, to directly kill a bacteria because it's more resistant or because it's in a less accessible tissue, the powerful stimulating effect it has on the immune system is usually more than enough to bring you to a cure of that infection as well. And probably even more impressive than what vitamin C does with infections such as viruses and bacteria is the fact that it's the nonspecific antidote to every poison there is out there.
Yes.
And to people that haven't heard that, that might seem like a fantastic statement. All I can tell you is it's true, because all toxins have the final common denominator of increasing oxidative stress. And vitamin C has the final common denominator of reducing oxidative stress. So Vitamin C is able to directly neutralize many toxins, but in all cases, it's able to immediately repair the damage the toxins do.
Is that true for glyphosate?
Well, let me put it this way. I don't know of a specific study on vitamin C and glyphosate, but I've seen this pattern in well over 100 toxins, and I've not seen any toxin that does not cause its damage by increasing oxidative stress. So I would say yes, although I don't have the proof for it. I mean, I have yet to say. I mean, vitamin C neutralizes anything, cyanide, you name it, mercury, pesticides, the list goes on and on and on. I'm not exaggerating when I say all toxins, because they all increase oxidative stress. So I couldn't imagine that it would not neutralize the effects of glyphosate and repair the oxidative damage that that toxin does.
That's just such a powerful concept for people to understand how important vitamin C is for all the toxins, including snake bites and botulism. That's just great news. Great, great news. A lot of people are worried about the Zika virus, and last year or a couple of years ago it was the Ebola. If you maintain good vitamin C levels, you have less to worry about with those viruses?
Well, that's the case with any virus. And if you keep your vitamin C levels high enough, you're generally not going to get an infectious disease. But there are always circumstances under which you might be uniquely exposed to a very large titer of an infectious disease all at once, and it can then get hold in your system, even if your antioxidant status is good. However, let me say this, and ironically enough, I wrote a little article on this already saying that, you know, Zika and Ebola would be easily cured. And in fact, we now have two papers in the literature, published in the literature, and of course completely ignored by the CDC and mainstream medicine, showing that vitamin C, just as we would expect, very easily cures Zika and very easily cures Ebola.
Great news. How about Candida and fungus?
Well, you know, Candida and fungus, those are diseases that are more likely to take a foothold because you've altered the substrate. The body is more susceptible to an infection. That combined with the fact that funguses grow very slow, I mean, when you have a virus or bacteria, you can have a profound effect quickly because the replication rate is so rapid. And so when you interrupt that, you can stop replication quickly. So in the case of funguses, it doesn't have the direct and dramatic impact that it has on viruses and bacteria, but large amounts of vitamin C and other antioxidant nutrients are definitely the foundation that you need to eventually, and I say eventually rather than rapidly, get a resolution of such things as Candida.
How about SIBO, small intestine bowel overgrowth?
Well, you know, vitamin C has an application when you take the powder, either as ascorbic acid or sodium ascorbate, and most people have a bowel tolerance of somewhere between 8 and 15 grams, and when you exceed that bowel tolerance, the osmotic effect of the vitamin C pulls in a lot of liquid, and you get a very quick bowel cleansing C flush. So that's a prelude to what I want to say when I say that vitamin C does a number of things when you take it in large doses orally. When it gets into the gut, it not only immediately starts to kill the pathogenic bacteria and other pathogens, microorganisms that are there, it also, because we said of the antitoxic effect, starts neutralizing all the toxins that have been generated in situ. So generally, there are very few abnormal intestinal or bowel circumstances under which, at least acutely, I'm not going to say it's going to do this for chronic ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, but for acute acquired intestinal disorders that have to do with pathogen overgrowth, doing a C flush, taking large amounts of C powder for several days in a row, and then taking a good probiotic when you're through is very good at rebooting, if you will, the gastrointestinal system and getting you back on a normal foot.
Great. So then it leads us to Lyme. Lyme is a soup of bacteria, viruses, mycoplasma. What's the scoop on Lyme and vitamin C?
Well, the interesting thing about Lyme is that Lyme is one of the prototypical hidden pathogens, okay? It not only, you know, gets into your blood and extracellular spaces, but it gets deep into the cells, and by all evidence, into the mitochondria, into the nucleus. And it's not that we don't have effective agents to treat Lyme. We do, but we don't have effective access to the pathogen. That combined with a very unique thing about the Lyme pathogen. All other pathogens other than Lyme characteristically accumulate iron in order to proliferate. And when you take vitamin C with this, it reduces the iron, and then that reduced iron contributes an electron to the hydrogen peroxide inside cells, causes the formation of something called hydroxyl radical, and then very rapidly kills the pathogen. In the case of Lyme, ironically enough, and I don't know really why this is the case, but it's well established that Lyme is the single pathogen that does not need iron to proliferate, and instead it bases its cytoplasmic chemistry on manganese rather than iron. And although manganese can activate the Fenton reaction like iron, it's just not as active. So all of this converts to the translates into the fact that Lyme requires, at least when you're talking about vitamin C, long-term high doses. I've seen a lot of success with vitamin C treating Lyme, but only at very high doses for extended periods of time, so that you get what I call a saturation inside the body of vitamin C, and that saturation can eventually make its way not only from the blood into the extracellular space, but deep inside the cells, and finally have a powerful antioxidant effect where the Lyme pathogen likes to hide. In fact, some 3 years ago, I got a note from a nurse. I'd given a talk at her hospital, and one of her patients that had Lyme's, and I don't know if it's because of what I said, but she said, well, I want to get IV vitamin C to take care of my Lyme, and I want to take high doses. And this is not economically feasible for many people, but this lady convinced the nurse to go ahead and give her 100 grams a day after working their way up from 25, 50, 75 grams, and do it every day that the hospital was open, or clinic, which was, I think, Monday through Friday. Now, the very interesting thing about this was for the first 22 infusions, the patient felt no improvement at all. Yet she was so motivated and convinced that it was going to do good, she still wanted to continue. And on day 23, according to this nurse, the patient came in as a new person. And in her words, it was like somebody flipped a switch and she was well. Well, we know everything didn't happen all of that one day. Things were going on for the first 22 days, but they were going on in the background, if you will, as the vitamin C saturation increased inside the blood and inside the cells even more. And, you know, that lady remains well to this day. A doctor I know of picked up on that after I talked about it, and he said, amazingly enough, he had pretty much the same response with 15 other patients where they pretty much showed no improvement until they got to their 19th, 20th, 21st infusion. And then, like he said, it was like a light was switched on, a very dramatic change. So I don't think Lyme is incurable. I think in many cases it's very difficult to deal with. And since biology is a very varied type of thing from one person to the next. You never really know from one person to the next what type of response to get, and you can't anticipate the same response in all patients, even if you do the same thing to them. But we're now finding, and I say we, who was Dr. Honeyhackey at the Reardon Clinic in Wichita, we've put together a high-dose vitamin C protocol, much like what I just said, combined with ozone treatment of the bloods and ultraviolet blood irradiation for Lyme patients, and patients who have any sort of infection for that matter. And we're seeing some very, very good success with that. So I don't think Lyme is incurable. I don't think Lyme is a death sentence or a sentence for severe illness the rest of your life. Nothing applies to 100% of people, but I think most people, if they get on high enough dose vitamin C for a prolonged period of time, and they can gain access to some of these oxidative protocols that we have now available with many physicians in different ozone therapies of the blood, we can start seeing resolution to many of these cases.
That's very exciting. What happens after day 23? They don't just stop their vitamin C, because the lifespan of these organisms, they have to continue, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, well, for one thing, obviously you don't have to continue 100 grams a day for the rest of your life. But what people need to realize, especially when they get a profound effect from vitamin C on a protocol like this, is that vitamin C is literally the fuel that your cells run on. And it's something that you need every day of your life, just like, unless you're a starving monk, you eat food every day of your life, because you need the nutrition. Same thing with vitamin C. So you could continue, after you get this response, on a fairly high dose of oral vitamin C, and even 3 or 4 more days worth of intravenous vitamin C, but there's no problem generally maintaining the advantage that you got of the Lyme pathogen after you get the dramatic response.
That's very exciting news. Now, would you consider that this, because vitamin C is intravenously has been effective with many cancers, would you say that it's more difficult with Lyme, or pretty much the same as treating cancer?
Well, you know, they're completely different animals. There are some cancers that respond very quickly and very dramatically to vitamin C. There's a few cancers that don't respond so well, and there's a bunch of cancers in between where vitamin C is a very good adjunctive measure to other things that you can use for cancer. Ironically enough, even though we labeled it as an infection protocol, the protocol at the Reardon Clinic with Dr. Honeyhackey, when we combine saturation vitamin C along with pro-oxidative ozone therapies, this is also enormously effective for most cancers. Cancer, again, similar to Lyme, can represent a disease where you don't always get the levels of vitamin C high enough where you want them to be high enough. So it's more a problem of access to the disease than it is the disease not responding. But sometimes when you have cancer patients that have a very high mass of cancer, like, you know, they might have a couple pounds worth of tumor in their body, and it's exquisitely sensitive to the vitamin C, you have to be very careful, because the vitamin C can kill the cancer so quickly that you literally flood the bloodstream with a lot of the breakdown products of the infection, and the patient can get acutely very sick and very toxic.
Yes. So, but then the vitamin C assists that with its antitoxic toxin?
Well, that's an interesting question that you asked, because when working with Dr. Honey some time back, we discovered that when vitamin C makes you sick, which means that it either detoxed the cell, killed a lot of viruses, bacteria, or killed a lot of cancer cells, all of which release iron and pro-oxidant debris into the blood, and then you start to get sick and feel lousy. Yes, in fact, the very thing that you use to treat that is more vitamin C, but just at a lower dose and a slower rate. So you don't give the vitamin C as fast as you did in as high a dose as you did, but you back off on the dose, you back off on the rate, and then the vitamin C just circulates in the bloodstream and starts neutralizing those toxins that were released, but the dose is no longer high enough to continue to kill new cells or release more toxins. So in answer to your question, yes, it actually can kill the cell or the pathogen, and then when you moderate the dose, give it more slowly at a much lower dose, like 1/4 of the dose at 1/2 of the rate, then you can have the patient feeling well by the time they leave the office, because you do, we call it a mop-up IV vitamin C. You just sort of, at a slower rate, lower dose, mop up the oxidative debris that you cause to be released into the bloodstream.
That's just so amazing. How about with parasites? What kind of work is there with the parasitic infections?
There's not a lot. You know, I don't think we could make the same broad sweeping statements about parasites and vitamin C that we can with the other pathogens. I mean, bear in mind that a lot of parasites take hold because the host is sick or immunocompromised, or the dose of parasite is high. So generally, for really large parasites that are, like, you know, occupying the gut, you're probably going to need something to effectively kill them and poison them, but you still need the benefit of something like vitamin C to deal with the oxidative stress from the toxins that are going to be released when various parts of those parasites get broken down and get reassimilated into the body and not directly excreted. So always keep in mind, of course, that vitamin C has the huge nonspecific supportive and stimulating effect on the immune system. So it's always going to be a benefit. And you also have to remember that all diseases, including parasites, consume vitamin C. So most people, not most people, all people, when they present with advanced infections, when they present with advanced diseases, giving vitamin C is absolutely indicated because they're already all deficient in vitamin C. So you're actually treating a subclinical form of scurvy, even when you don't give high doses of vitamin C to patients that have been ill for a long time, chronic infections, and definitely cancer and other advanced chronic degenerative diseases.
Just as a minor aside, I'm a student of colon hydrotherapy, and on the days where I kick my vitamin C dose up, the amount of worms and parasites in the release is many times greater. So just a little anecdote. Can you tell us what the para-aminobenzoic acid does when you combine it with vitamin C?
You know, that's something that Dr. Klenner did a lot, and I quite honestly have no familiarity with it, so I'm not in a position to give you a pro or a con. I will say there's really nothing that I know of in reviewing the work of Dr. Klenner that I found he was off or mistaken about anything, so odds are it's something good that can be added, but I can't give you any definitive advice on that.
Can you explain the different types of vitamin C, and how do you know when to use one or the other, of course, with the exception of intravenous when you need very high doses?
Well, part of the concept on the protocol that we developed with Dr. Honeyhackey in the Reardon Clinic was to, with a given disease or an infection, to try to achieve vitamin C saturation. Now, they have a form of vitamin C called liposome encapsulated. And this is vitamin C inside nanosphere balls of fat that have the same outer membrane as a regular cell. And when you take this, you get almost a complete absorption from the gut. And then, and this is the dramatic part, the circulating liposomes are then able to go to all the different cells of the body and either merge with the cell wall or pass through the pores of the cell and deposit the vitamin C directly into the cytoplasm or even into an intracellular organelle like the mitochondria. So this is the best biodelivery system that currently exists is when you take something in the form of a liposome. So liposomes do a lot of great things. I first got involved with liposomes. I'm a consultant to the company that has done most of the work with this, Livon Labs. And I saw in my own personal experience where 5 grams of liposome encapsulated vitamin C taken orally had a greater impact on an acute viral syndrome and influenza I was getting than I'd seen happen with 50 grams of vitamin C in the past. And I couldn't figure this out, so I did the next logical thing. I ignored it. And I needed to see it repeated several times with myself, family, and friends until several months down the road. I said, hey, guess what, idiot? It's about time you figure out what a liposome is. So actually, in terms of an acute viral infection, I would prefer to have oral liposomes to intravenous. Now, that's not putting down intravenous. Intravenous has an incredible niche. As you said, it gets very high doses into the blood. It gets very high doses into the extracellular fluid. And you can basically flood the body very quickly and very easily with intravenous vitamin C. You just don't get the delivery inside the cells that you get with the liposomes. So you have the liposomal C, you have the IVC, you have the powder, sodium ascorbate, or ascorbic acid. I generally prefer sodium ascorbate because it doesn't upset the stomach like oftentimes the ascorbic acid can do due to the acidic nature of it. But like we were talking about earlier with the C flush and people with pathogen overgrowth in their gut, you get a unique impact from oral vitamin C in the powder form because you neutralize toxicity directly. You get a large amount of vitamin C directly absorbed into the intestine and then into the immune cells that surround the gut. A very large percentage of our immune system is localized in our gut, you know, to deal with oftentimes the pathogens or the toxins that we're exposed to in food, in meals, that sort of thing. Then they have another form of vitamin C that when I'm trying to get somebody to cover all their bases that I advocate, and that's a form called ascorbyl palmitate. Ascorbyl palmitate is a form that they put together and is uniquely fat soluble. Normally, vitamin C is water soluble, but when you hook it up with this palmitate, it becomes fat soluble, and that vitamin C is able to do a lot more good for repairing and preventing oxidative damage to the cell membranes and other fatty areas inside your body. So those are your main forms. You know, you have other things. I'd never advocate calcium ascorbate. I don't know how well you're familiar with all my books, but I wrote another book called Death by Calcium. And the worst thing that you can supplement anytime, anywhere is calcium. Never, never, never supplement calcium in any form and minimize your dairy. Because even though calcium is essential for life, in excess, it's also essential for death. And it directly is related to the increased oxidative stress that you see inside all the disease cells in your body. So that's far too big a topic to take up here, but just to say, this is ester C. Ester C is calcium ascorbate. Avoid ester C. Don't take ester C. Don't take any extra supplemental forms of calcium.
Yeah, that's really important for both men and women. But, you know, the women are so brainwashed around menopause or childbearing to take extra calcium. So That's a very important point to...
The truly sad, ironic thing is that it is all in the literature. It is not just something I'm pulling off the top of my head, but you can take as much calcium as you want, and the large population studies show they don't decrease your chance of osteoporotic fracture. Well, that's the whole point, supposedly, of taking calcium, is so that you don't get an osteoporotic fracture. So number one, the supplemental calcium does not decrease your chance of fracture. And number two, it astronomically increases your chance of heart attack and cancer.
Yes, very important point. Thank you, Dr. Levy. Can you tell us, do we have to worry about GMO and non-GMO sourcing of vitamin C?
Yeah, you know, I wrote a little article on this for Natural Health 365, and it's important to understand. As when it comes to GMOs, I mean, GMOs, there's no doubt about it. And I hope nobody mistakes what I'm saying for the fact that I support GMO. In no way. I mean, they should stop messing with our food. It's horrible what they do. They put toxins in there. There's glyphosate. There's all the other these other bad things. However, they're not the boogeyman. They're just another toxin. And when you deal with, say, GMO corn, all right? Absolutely don't eat GMO corn. But does that mean you can't take that corn and purify something you're taking out of the corn? Of course you can. You can take toilet water and purify it to the point where it's drinkable. So you can take GMO-contaminated corn and purify it to the point where you have an absolutely wonderful source of vitamin C. So I think people get a little loco on this GMO stuff. It's kind of like if GMO has anything to do with it, it's somehow tainted forever. No, it's just another molecule that you can purify out of a product, and you can make a perfectly good supplement out of a GMO-derived source. Now, that drives a lot of people crazy when they hear that because, like I said, they have this emotional reaction, but they shouldn't be any more emotional about glyphosate that they should be about fluoride in their toothpaste.
Right. Well, we're crazy about that too.
Yeah.
I know another important thing, so important. Can you comment on the use of vitamin C in transfusions? I think the transfusion industry is just so poorly regulated. There are so many things that they don't test for, like Lyme in blood for transfusions. But that would probably be improved if they coordinated vitamin C with it. Is that correct?
No, that'd be incredibly beneficial. It's interesting, without getting too much into conspiratorial stuff and why things happen the way they do, but it's just incredible the number of things that are forced upon us on, that are toxic, and the number of things that are clearly good for us that aren't part of what we take. I mean, so absolutely, if they routinely gave vitamin C and actually an ozone treatment to transfuse blood, that'd be the purest blood imaginable. There's no known pathogen that could survive that 1-2 punch, and you would completely overnight, in my opinion, my scientific and medical opinion, completely eliminate the chance of any transfusion mediated or born illness that could be transmitted. It just couldn't happen. Now, different viruses at different profiles, and you know, they all come up with their scare factor, the microcephaly with Zika, the rapid death with Ebola, but they still have all very simple common denominators, and they're all easily nuked by vitamin C and ozone. So that would be phenomenal if the transfusion industry ever wised up and did that.
Yes. So because of the reactive...
Actually, you know, that you just made me think of another good point, too. If, for example, you're ready to get a transfusion, for whatever reason, you should, if at all possible, take as much orally and or intravenously of vitamin C as possible before and after the fact. And if there is an infectious agent in that blood, you'll very likely knock it out before it has a chance to take hold.
Yes, I think that's such a powerful point. But it would be hard to get an intravenous vitamin C infusion.
But I tell you what, if you go in the hospital and you don't have a tube down your throat, and your relatives bring you in what you need, and when the nurse isn't in the room, you take your damn lipospheric vitamin C, and you're going to get just about the same protection. So as long as you don't have a tube down your throat, and you can take some oral applications, you can give yourself pretty good protection.
Just so people know, you can also take a rectal implant of vitamin C, is that right?
Well, you can take an enema of vitamin C. I'm not. Is that what you mean by an implant?
Yes.
I mean, they
yes.
talk about, yeah, that's,
yes.
sure, that's, and ozone. Ozone is administratable by rectal insufflation, and both of them were delivered very well. No, the rectal mucosa is very effective at absorbing and assimilating whatever agents it comes in contact with.
So the vitamin C works in the mitochondria, would you say?
Sure. No, the vitamin C, there's not a component or a site in the body where vitamin C doesn't play a role. Now, there's certainly some tissues and some cells that have much higher concentrations of vitamin C than others. For example, the macrophages, which are immune cells in your body, have 80,000% more vitamin C inside them than is in the blood. And probably the reason for this is because whenever you have an inflammation, you start to have an infection, you have an inflammation, and you summon the immune system, what are the first cells that come there? The first cells that come are the monocytes. And what is always present when you have inflammation? When you have inflammation, you have increased oxidative stress and the rapid consumption of vitamin C at that site. So what is the body doing? The immune system is bringing to the site of your vitamin C deficiency, the inflamed area, the cells that have the highest doses of vitamin C inside the body. So it's a pretty elegant little mechanism.
Maybe you can comment, because they both work on calcium channels, the endocannabinoid system, and vitamin C.
I don't know that vitamin C has so much an interaction with the calcium channels. We do know that, this is in the book Death by Calcium, that vitamin C is very effective at mobilizing calcium, and by its chemical nature, and this is very fascinating, I found this in a paper that was published in the 1930s, vitamin C in solution can dissolve more calcium than hydrochloric acid or sulfuric acid. So it's really profoundly capable of putting calcium into solution. Now, like I said, I don't know that what its effects are on the calcium channels, but it has part of its reason that vitamin C, when you get your blood level high and keep it high, you decrease all-cause mortality. You decrease your chance of death from everything. And one of the big reasons for that is when you get those levels up, you're able to mobilize calcium and get the calcium inside the cell down. But I'm not aware of any direct interaction with the calcium channels of vitamin C.
Okay. Two quick last questions. What's the future of vitamin C?
The future of vitamin C?
Yeah.
You know, the future of vitamin C rests completely on the shoulders of three letters. FDA. Okay? The Food and Drug Administration is, gosh, in my opinion, just, and this is saying a lot considering there's so much corruption in government, but the FDA, in my opinion, is far and away the most corrupt government agency there is. I mean, it's almost at the point where if the FDA does something, I just assume the exact opposite action is the one that's in the best interest of the people. They have some legislation up that could severely affect our access to all forms of all supplement forms, including vitamin C. And I hope and pray it doesn't come through. But the sad fact of the matter, Sally, is there is more. And I say this absolutely sincerely, and I do not mean to exaggerate. There is more politics in medicine than there is in politics.
Yes. Sad statement.
I mean, the public just wants to believe that they're just going to magically get taken care of, and they just refuse to get a grip on the fact that the only thing that runs this whole show is money. That's it. Okay? You know, it's excellent if you can find a doctor that you can just absolutely feel wonderful about. Then you're in good shape. But nobody, in my opinion, should see any physician, doctor, medical practitioner that's not willing to take some time, sit down, and objectively address every question that they have. If they start to ask questions that make the doctor uncomfortable, then I say, don't walk, run out of that office. I mean, you have to be the primary caretaker of your own health. Because if you don't, I'm sorry, but you're going to die a whole lot younger and you're going to be a whole lot sicker for the time that you're alive, in my opinion.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Levy. Can I ask you, what is your vitamin regimen?
Well, there's the big four. And this is in the calcium book, too. And I say it's the big four because we have studies that show each one of these things is a separate agent, decreases all-cause mortality. So if you eat any one of these things you take, it decreases your chance of death from everything. That's magnesium, and you want to get that in the multi-100-gram dose. Vitamin D, but that has to be maintained in a normal range, 50 to 80 nanogram per cc. And vitamin C, of course, and vitamin K. Those are your big four. After that, there's a lot of things that are good. There's the B vitamins, of course. There's coenzyme Q10. But the thing is after you get past the first six or seven supplements, like those four, plus a B vitamin, plus a coenzyme Q10, maybe an N-acetylcysteine, the bottom line is there are literally probably thousands, but certainly many hundreds of supplements out there that are quality. They have nutrient antioxidant capacity, and they are good for you. But you run into two big problems. You run into the fact that your stomach gets full and your pocketbook gets empty. So you have to get the balance between what you are comfortable taking, what you can afford, and make sure you have the bases covered. It's always good to track what you do with baseline blood work, and even if you don't have a doctor to work with, you could go to Life Extension Foundation and order your own blood work and see if certain critical values are in the reference range or not. So you can keep track of yourself. I still recommend you find a doctor. It's just it's a little harder to find a good doctor, in my opinion, than most people encounter. But it's good to find a health partner, track your blood work, and take the most quality antioxidant regimen you can without stomach upset and too badly depleting your pocketbook.
Thank you, Dr. Levy. You've been a wealth of information, and we're going to pass it along to as many people as we can. And thank you for your time and your expertise.
Okay. Thank you, Sally. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
Take care.